Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 918, the Truppenkampfverbande part 1, German Ostpolitik. This is being recorded on August 18th of the year 2016. This has been so far a entertaining presidential election campaign, and boy, if that isn't a euphemism, I don't know what is. And it has also been characterized by a strident level of propaganda and misinformation and disinformation. And I'm going to continue to do my humble best to straighten at least some of that out. One of the interesting aspects to the journalistic, and that probably belongs in quotes, portrayal of Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, is that he is a dupe of Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. This owes to several things. Putin had some relatively benign comments about Trump, basically said he thought he was a dynamic individual, which he certainly is, and some other things that really were not the endorsement they were made out to be. Also, since Trump, at least at the time those comments were made, might turn out to be the president of the U.S., it was a diplomatically politic statement to make at the time. On top of that, there is a fair amount of Russian oligarch and Russian organized crime investment in some of Trump's high-end real estate projects, which has then been spun into Trump, is a Putin dupe. Actually, high-end real estate is a very common money laundering investment vehicle, and one will find all sorts of relatively strange bedfellows sinking their dollars, rubles, euros, or what have you into the same project, not necessarily indicating that they are political allies of the entrepreneur whose project that is, but rather that they need to invest and launder money, and also perhaps get in on the ground floor, pun intended, of what might turn out to be a lucrative investment. Even more than that, Trump has made some very hostile comments to NATO, some strongly anti-NATO comments, and in turn has had some relatively kind things to say about Russia's involvement with Ukraine. Russia has not invaded Ukraine. That is disinformation. They did finally accede to a long-standing Crimean desire to reunite with Russia. Crimea had been part of Russia for 150 years. Then Khrushchev, the premier of the former Soviet Union, I think it was in 54, had Crimea become part of Ukraine for a long time. Crimea has wanted to be part of Russia because Ukraine has been a cesspool for a long time after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And when the OUNB fascists came to power in Ukraine again, and that is exactly what is going on behind the carefully spun facade of people like Petro Poroshenko, the old OUNB fascists have returned to power. Of course, their heirs are the ones who are in power now. The OUNB held sway during World War II and became part of the Underground Reich, the ABN, working with CIA and BND in the post-war period. Ultimately, they have returned to power. We've talked about that in many programs. For the record, 779 and 780 were the first two, talking about the return to power of the OUNB. For background, for the record, 777, 778, and 76 will give you some idea of what has been going on with the OUNB. Beyond that is to say, Crimea basically had opted to reunite with Russia for a long time. They were rebuffed under Yeltsin. And finally, when the U.S., NATO, the EU, and Germany were moving to cut Russian access off to the Black Sea, and when the people of Crimea, who, unlike people in the U.S., know full well who the OUNB were, viewed with deserved horror the return of the Ukrainian World War II-era fascist to power, they basically said to Russia, please take us back, and that happened. Russia did not annex or invade Ukraine. They already had a bunch of troops there, and they did not annex Crimea, I should say. They already had a bunch of troops there, and the people of Crimea, unlike the people of the U.S., knew who the OUNB were, and they supported a referendum to reunite with Russia. In this country, the big lie is well underway, and it is assuming Hitlerian proportions. What we're going to do in this program is to examine the supposed pro-Kremlin, pro-Putin orientation of Trump, which is being spun as Trump is a Kremlin/Putin/Russian puppet. Another aspect of that, which we will talk about more in the second part of our analysis of the Trumpen Kampfverbande. By the way, that is a personal invention. That's my name for the Trump campaign, and beyond that, the Trump phenomena. TrumpenKampfverbande. Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, who replaced Roger Stone, the GOP tricks analyst par excellence, now working with Julian Assange by his own account. Paul Manafort had previously worked as an advisor to Viktor Yanukovych. He was the pro-Russian prime minister of Ukraine and was the fellow who was chased out of power by the Maidan coup. Paul Manafort certainly had some financial connections to the Yanukovych regime, for which he was working as an advisor. The probability is very strong that he was a double agent helping to prepare the way for the Maidan coup. The cardinal rule, by the way, for a good double agent is, quote, make yourself indispensable to the effort. All of Manafort's connections go to the far right and underground Reich and underground Axis. He was a veteran of the Reagan administration, and in the 1980s, he worked as an advisor to Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines at the very time that Marcos was accessing huge amounts of the golden lily treasure that had been stashed in the Philippines by the Japanese. We have talked about that at great length in our many programs dealing with the seminal text Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, the point being that Manafort does not appear to be a Russian tool at all. Beyond that, we'll cover this at greater length in our next program. The Prime Minister of Ukraine under Yanukovych, working with Manafort, was none other than Petro Poroshenko, the current head of state in Ukraine. By the twisted logic that we are being fed, well, Manafort worked with Yanukovych, and he was Trump's campaign manager. Yanukovych was allied with Russia, therefore Manafort and Trump are allied with Russia. Well, that same non-logic or pretzel logic applied to Poroshenko and his pivotal role in the economic administration, or misadministration, as it really was, of Yanukovych, who was more or less routinely corrupt routine for Ukrainian heads of states and Ukrainian administrations, and that is very corrupt indeed. Poroshenko is allied with the U.S., with the EU, and with the West in general. Therefore, the U.S. and the EU and the West in general must be Putin puppets slash dupes slash allies. Obviously, that dog won't hunt at all. What we're going to be looking at in this program is how Trump's relatively benign comments about Russia and his comments about Ukraine and his anti-NATO comments play directly into traditional German Ostpolitik. This is going to be one of those programs in connection with which listeners should most emphatically use the books that I have available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. One of the books that will be front and center here was published in 1953 at the very depth of the Joe McCarthy period and one of the darkest points in the old Cold War. Now we are in the new Cold War with Donald Trump being portrayed as a Russian dupe. This is sort of a neo-McCarthyism. T.H. Pettens was an expert on Pan-Germanism and advised the U.S. during World War II. He also had another book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, that is also available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, bear in mind, this book was published in 1953. From Germany, Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Pettens, a title, by the way, more or less crafted to appeal to the Cold War-oriented audience, political audience in that time period, 1953. On the back cover, Pettens presents a thumbnail synopsis of traditional German Ostpolitik. I'm going to read that for background, then we're going to delve further into the subject and see how Trump's pronouncements about Russia and NATO actually fit very nicely into the pan-German Ostpolitik agenda. From the back cover of Germany Plots with the Kremlin, 1762, Frederick the Great. Frederick's secret pact with Tsar Peter III disrupted the great European coalition which had almost crushed Prussia in the Seven Years' War. This pact saved Prussia from total defeat and led to the first partition of Poland. 1887, Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. The Iron Chancellor, unquote, made a secret pact or reinsurance treaty with Russia which secured Germany's eastern frontier. He made Germany the strongest military power on the continent, and German Weltpolitik set out to intimidate France and to undermine the Anglo-Saxon world. 1922, General Hans von Seeckt, S-E-E-C-K-T. General von Seeckt created a new army after Germany's defeat in World War I. His secret deals with Moscow culminated in the Rapallo Treaty, which rocked the Western world on Easter Sunday, 1922. 1926, Gustav Stresemann, S-T-R-E-S-E-M-A-N. Stresemann, a good European, unquote, signed a neutrality pact with the Soviets, which in effect was a return to Bismarck's policy of securing the eastern frontier. While Stresemann feigned friendship for the West, the Wehrmacht chief general von Seeckt contemplated, quote, war against the West in alliance with the East, unquote. 1939, von Ribbentrop and Stalin. Hitler's foreign minister, after months of secret negotiations with the Soviets, signed on August 23, 1939, a so-called non-aggression pact in Moscow. A week later, Hitler launched his war against Poland, the opening move of World War II. Note that in the time period we're going to be looking at, the late 1940s and the early 1950s, the vast bulk of Adenauer's diplomats were taken from the Foreign Office of von Ribbentrop. He was Hitler's foreign minister.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
What we're going to look at next is literally an open letter to Stalin. This was published in 1949. And worth noting here is that the paper that published it, the Burger Zeitung, that's capital B-U-E-R-G-E-R, capital Z-E-I-T-U-N-G, as a leading German language paper in the U.S. It also was extremely right-wing. It was very close to and an advocate for Joseph McCarthy's witch hunts. It also was the de facto journalistic outlet for the Steuben Society, that's capital S-T-E-U-B-E-N. That is named after Baron Friedrich von Steuben, who fought in the U.S. Revolutionary War. The Steuben Society, as we will see, served as part of the Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. before World War II, and served as part of the underground Reich infrastructure in the U.S. after the war. In that latter capacity, it advocated for the release and rehabilitation of Nazis, including war criminals, working basically with people like Otto Skorzeny and Hans Ulrich Rudel, about whom we have spoken in the past. Now, the author of this paper is Bruno Fricke, B-R-U-N-O, capital F-R-I-C-K-E. He was an associate of Otto Strasser, who was working with him. Otto Strasser and his brother Gregor Strasser were part of the SA, the Sturm at Peiling of Ernst Röhm. They were the brown-shirted street-fighting cadre of Hitler. They were liquidated. The leadership was liquidated in the Night of the Long Knives by the SS in 1934. Gregor Strasser was killed in the Night of the Long Knives, and Otto Strasser then fled to Czechoslovakia initially and became an anti-Hitler propagandist while still advocating a form of German National Socialism, although not one that was pro-Hitler. Note, too, in this regard, that the lawyer for a long time for Donald Trump, who is himself of German-American heritage, we'll talk more about that in our next program, the lawyer for Donald Trump up until his death was Roy Cohn, the top aide to Joe McCarthy, whom, as we saw in AFA program number 2 from May of 1984, received a lot of financial backing from German-American and Hitler sympathizers in Wisconsin. So again, what we're looking at is basically an open letter to Stalin, published in 1949 in the Burger Zeitung, a leading German language paper in North America. The author, Bruno Fricke, and his ally Otto Strasser, basically part of the Nazi movement, part of which was liquidated by the SS in 1934, but continued to work on behalf of the Reich. That is to say, Bruno Fricke did. And we're going to see how this, the response this generated. Now, this, again, is from Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tuttens, by Henry Schumann, the hardcover edition, published in 1953. Since 1947, many German-language papers in North and South America have endeavored to pressure the U.S. with the veiled threat that if Germany were not fully restored to her former position of power, the German people would ally themselves with Russia. In 1949, the German-language paper Bürger Zeitung of Chicago published on its front page under a six-column headline, quote, "An open letter to Stalin." It was a most brazen example of how ruthless German realpolitik can be. The author, Herr Bruno Fricke, F-R-I-C-K-E, is a former Nazi and Black Front leader and a political collaborator of Dr. Otto Strasser. The Bürger Zeitung is an old and respected German-language weekly that carries on its masthead the notice that it is the, quote, official organ of the German-American Citizens League of Illinois. The paper boasts that it is the mouthpiece for the sentiments of 500,000 German-Americans in Chicago. It speaks for the German-American Citizens League and for the German Day Association, which includes 91 German-American societies in Chicago. The Steuben Society, the leading pan-German organization in the U.S. for years, uses the Bürger Zeitung for its announcements. Thus, in a respected German-American publication which has its place on the extreme right politically and has wholeheartedly given support to Senator McCarthy's anti-communist campaign, the open letter to Stalin was splashed all over the front page. And what did the letter say? It proposed nothing less than that Germany and Russia should form an alliance and smash the coalition of Western powers. Addressing Stalin, the author writes, quote, "Your intelligence service will tell you who I am. Essential and important and interesting for you is only that I am speaking here as a representative of a great part of my Volks Genossenschaft, V-O-L-K-S-G-E-N-O-S-S-E-N, and that it would be good for you to know what millions of battle-trained men think today." Again, this is 1949. This sector of the German people, namely the national sector, which not only comprises former Nazis, but everyone who feels for the fatherland, is quantitatively quite noteworthy and qualitatively of decisive importance. Its components are the frontline soldiers of both of the world wars and the overwhelming majority of our youth. Thus, its importance from the purely military point of view become clear, and this is one of the reasons why the opinions of these circles must be worthy of your consideration. In view of the imminent Third World War, as well as in view of principal considerations, you are naturally very much interested in us Germans. We may be down materially, morally, and ethically. Nevertheless, and despite the dismemberment of our fatherland, we remain with 80 million the strongest people on the European continent. Whatever one will tell you, we consider ourselves absolutely as a unity, and nobody will drive these ideas from our heads, not for generations to come. Stressing the importance of Germany's industrial capacity and the intellectual potentialities of the Germans, the writer explains that after Truman's announcement about a Russian atomic explosion, quote, "Europe's decisive role in the pending showdown," unquote, "has become greater than ever before." Having obviously in mind a German-dominated Europe, the writer continues, note again, having obviously in mind a German-dominated Europe, which is what we have today, the writer continues, quote, "You, Generalissimo Stalin, are probably much more conscious of the fact than the civilian governments in Washington, London, and Paris, that the Western Union, as well as the Atlantic Pact, are nothing but an organization of military zeros around an Anglo-Saxon one." Continuing, the writer comes to the key point of his letter by suggesting that if Stalin would restore German sovereignty, he could, quote, "win back the German people's fist." Quote, We Germans do not want to have anything to do with the West, with the Yankees, with their capitalistic exploitation and their political arrogance. We Prussians have always been closely associated with the Russians. We Germans return gladly to the traditions of Bismarck, Freiherr von Stein, and Empress Maria Theresa of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and we as a politically trained people have never forgotten Lenin's intelligent words about the desire of cooperation between Germany and Russia. We are actually predestined for an alliance with Moscow, all the more so since mutual cooperation with the integrated bloc of the Soviet states has attracted millions of Germans educated under strict discipline. Who could resist us if our Reichs were united? What Napoleon did not succeed in doing, Truman will not succeed in either, the subjugation of the earth. Socialist Germany and communist Russia together are invincible, and thus our potential alliance secures the peace of the world. This and subsequent articles which propagated a German-Russia alliance published in an outspoken anti-communist paper in the U.S. neatly illustrates the essence of German Realpolitik. The authors, Bruno Fricke and Dr. Otto Strasser, are known as daring political plotters. In addition to their regular writings for the Chicago Burger Zeitung, their articles have been published frequently in the German-language press in North and South America. Some people say that the views of Dr. Strasser, Herr Fricke, and others of the same stripe represent only the thinking of a minority. The fact is, however, that there were no articulate voices of protest whatsoever among the 500,000 German-Americans in Chicago against this open letter to Stalin. The Burger Zeitung is read in the editorial rooms of dozens of other German-language papers in the USA, and there is no evidence that any other German-language newspaper or any of the numerous German-American societies in Chicago for whom the Burger Zeitung serves as an official mouthpiece protested against this dangerous and open plotting. A sensational front-page feature like this open letter to Stalin could not have been overlooked by anybody, not even State Senator Charles Weber, the political bigwig among the German-Americans in Illinois, who himself utilizes the Burger Zeitung as his political instrument. The fact that the Burger Zeitung could carry on a blackmail campaign in favor of Germany for years and even promote a Russo-German alliance with the West without encountering any criticism from patriotic stalwarts is proof of the extraordinarily strong position of leading German-American circles in American political life. It is easy to imagine what would have happened if this open letter to Stalin would have appeared in the Daily Worker, or in a Hungarian, Polish, or a French-language paper in the USA. The open letter to Stalin would have been exposed under screaming headlines. Congressional investigation would have been going on for months under Krieg lights, and our FBI would have gone into immediate action. But nothing like this happens when German-American groups are engaged in promoting this kind of Realpolitik. Now again, that open letter to Stalin appeared in the Burger Zeitung, the outlet for the Steuben Society, in 1949. On March 10th, 1952, the Soviet Union under Stalin basically had a radical proposition, the so-called Soviet Note of March of 1952, which was in response to not only the open letter to Stalin in the Burger Zeitung, but in general, a response to German Ostpolitik under Konrad Adenauer. Once again, from Germany, Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens. Now, note in this, not only the German manifestation of traditional Ostpolitik, but how an explicitly Nazi milieu and Adenauer's government was nothing if not that, as we have seen in many programs. And do read the book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, published 8 years after this book by T.H. Tetens, also available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Note in this, not only the German readiness to ally itself with the Soviet Union in exchange for concessions from the Kremlin, in particular territorial concessions in Eastern Europe, also the desire for Germany to establish a unified Europe under German control as a third power bloc. And beyond that, that unified Europe under German control would ultimately move out of NATO. Note also the desire to establish a pan-European army in that third bloc under German domination, because these are key elements of the fruit, so to speak, of German Ostpolitik as advocated by Adenauer. And as we shall see later, that is basically what is taking place in the EU at this time. Again, Donald Trump and his statements about Ukraine and against NATO and the relatively benign statements about Russia are being interpreted as meaning that he is a Russian dupe. I would submit that what he is doing is basically advancing traditional German Ostpolitik, and I think the evidence suggests very strongly that Trump is underground Reich / Bormann Capital Network.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now again, from Germany plots with the Kremlin, we're moving up 3 years in time. This is at 1952. The book was published in 1953. The world caught a glimpse of how the bond diplomacy works on the occasion of the Soviet note of March of 1952, addressed to the three Western powers and suggesting a new solution for the German problem. The Russians, who for almost 7 years pretended to defend the principles of the Potsdam Agreement, made a 180-degree turnabout by offering German reunification on the basis of free elections, a new German Wehrmacht fully rearmed, the decontrolling of Germany's industrial war potential, and the return of former Nazis and Wehrmacht officers to public life. It is no exaggeration to say that the Soviet note had an electrifying effect on the German people, regardless of class or political persuasion. The Soviet note was the German dream come true. It opened up new perspectives for Germany's ambitions to establish a Fourth Reich free from the controls of the Allies. Before we continue, what basically is going on here as well is sort of a playing of both sides against the middle. By threatening to ally with the Soviets, the Germans were able to win huge concessions from the West. Basically, in effect, no, don't do that, we'll give you whatever we want. So by dallying with the Soviets, or in the latter case with Russia, Germany was able to win tremendous concessions from the West and the U.S. in particular on many things, including the rearming of Germany, the reestablishment of Nazis in high positions of power in Germany, and the untethering of German corporations, and thereby the Bormann Capital Network, which, as we have seen, controls corporate Germany. From Germany Plots of the Kremlin, again, 1952. The world caught a glimpse of how they're actually continuing here. At first, Dr. Adenauer brushed the Soviet note aside as inconsequential, but when he encountered growing opposition, even among his most faithful party followers, Dr. Adenauer was forced to lift slightly the veil that hides the strategy of German diplomacy. Unquestionably, the Chancellor did not think the time was ripe for candor, but the opposition had forced his hand. It was his task to explain, unquote, the basic principles of the Baum government's foreign policy without making embarrassing disclosures. It should be pointed out that the explanation, unquote, of Baum's foreign policy came not only from the lips of Adenauer, but from inspired stories and leaks which appeared in the pro-Adenauer press. In leading German newspapers, it was stated that Dr. Adenauer's policy runs on two tracks. There is first the European concept, a short-term policy which aims at the creation of a united Europe, or to use the expression of one German editorial, quote, to fulfill the goal for which Germans were dreaming for decades. One more time. In leading German papers, it was stated that Dr. Adenauer's policy runs on two tracks. There is first the European concept, a short-term policy which aims at the creation of a united Europe, or to use the expression of one German editorial, to fulfill the goal for which Germans were dreaming for decades, unquote. Of course, that has now happened. Continuing. In confidential talks with some members of the federal parliament, Dr. Adenauer declared that negotiations with the Russians would have to wait until Germany had regained a strong and dominant position in European affairs. He assured his listeners that Russia's conciliatory attitude was most helpful to Germany's aspirations, and that other Russian offers were to be expected in which even greater concessions would be made to Germany, especially on the territorial question of the Oder-Neisse line. The Chancellor hinted in his talks that the Soviet note had created the heated atmosphere of an auction room where two eager opponents outbid each other. This is fundamental because that was what was going on then. It was the German word for power is Macht. It's derived from Machiavellian. And again, what was happening here is that both sides were being played against the middle. That, in my opinion, is what we are seeing now. Certainly Germany is doing that, and I think that Trump is simply an agent of the underground Reich, perhaps without fully realizing it. Repeating this last sentence. The Chancellor hinted in his talks that the Soviet note had created the heated atmosphere of an auction room where two eager opponents outbid each other. Therefore, he assured his listeners that the rejection of the first Soviet note would not prevent an agreement with the Russians at a more favorable moment. The essence of Dr. Adenauer's views was outlined on April 3, 1952, in one of Germany's leading newspapers, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is often employed as the mouthpiece of the Bonn Foreign Office. In the front-page editorial, this newspaper stated, quote, the Chancellor follows a tremendously bold plan. First, rearmament followed later on by talks with the Russians in order to persuade them to remove their armies behind the Bug River, that's B-U-G. For this goal, the Chancellor has been working tenaciously for some time. And because he sticks to his timetable, he is presently opposed to the Russian note, unquote. Dr. Adenauer's tremendously bold plan was prepared by the Ribbentrop diplomats as a time bomb which one day will blast asunder everything U.S. foreign policy has built up since 1945. The German Chancellor's plan is that the USA is now so deeply committed to her European defense pledge that she will readily sacrifice dozens of billions of dollars in the strengthening and the rearming of a German-dominated Europe. After this is accomplished, Dr. Adenauer's grandiose concept envisions negotiations with Russia with the prospect of getting substantial territorial concessions from the Kremlin in Eastern Europe, for which Germany, in return, will break away with the whole of Western Europe from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Again, this is 1952. I'm going to read this last couple of sentences for emphasis. In my opinion, the statements and policy hints that Donald Trump has issued vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine and NATO do not indicate that he is a Russian dupe or a Putin tool, but rather that he is an operative perhaps not altogether consciously, of the underground Reich and is expressing elements of traditional German Ostpolitik, here being embraced by the Adenauer government, which is simply a front for rehabilitated or reinstated Nazis. They were not rehabilitated. Repeating again, the German Chancellor's plan is that the USA is now so deeply committed to her European defense pledge that she will readily sacrifice dozens of billions of dollars in the strengthening and the rearming of a German-dominated Europe. After this is accomplished, Dr. Adenauer's grandiose concept envisions negotiations with Russia with the prospect of getting substantial territorial concessions from the Kremlin in Eastern Europe, for which Germany in return will break away with the whole of Western Europe from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In the pro-Adenauer press, including the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the Christ und Welt, the Deutsche Zeitung of Stuttgart, editorials have been written assuring the Russians that Dr. Adenauer's policy aims to create the security necessary for both the Germans and the Russians, and that this can only be brought about after Germany had become a third power factor which could employ its influence in such a way as to deter the United States, quote, from starting a preventive war, unquote. Thus, while in the short run the Bonn government aims to create a united Europe, again this is 1952 and that has happened, it hopes ultimately to reach a solid understanding with the Soviets at the expense of the United States. It is true, of course, that in the person of Dr. Adenauer, the West has been led to believe that the Bonn government is deeply devoted to the furtherance of the common welfare of the West. But these estimates of Dr. Adenauer and his diplomacy are based on superficial evidence and ignore the fact that Dr. Adenauer was in the past a fanatical believer in the pan-German gospel that the fatherland should rule Europe and the world. It is therefore no accident that the Ribbentrop diplomats and the Haushofer geopoliticians should be his chief advisors. They are prepared to create the third power bloc under German domination through the financial help of the U.S. and then turn around and make their final bargain with Moscow. Trained in the school of Realpolitik, Dr. Adenauer is not one who acts like a bull in a china shop. Even before he became chancellor, he admonished his German compatriots, quote, "We must move very cautiously. We ought not to give the impression either in Germany or in the U.S. that we shall collaborate in any way with the Russians," unquote. The reaction of the German strategists to the Soviet note of March 10, 1952, however, exposes their true designs. German geopolitical journals speak of it as, quote, "the highest Trump card in the hands of the Chancellor," unquote, which will enable him to mow down the resistance of France against Germany's concept of a united Europe. The pro-Adenauer press interpreted the Russian note as a tremendous asset in speeding up the timetable for the creation of a European army under German domination. And as we will see, corporate Germany is very much advocating for a lifting of the sanctions against Russia because they've lost a lot of money. And beyond that, for an alliance of the Eurasian Trade Organization dominated by Russia and the EU. More about that later. And we will be continuing this analysis in our next program as well. Note the Machiavellian oscillation in which basically at this point in time the Soviet Union, now Russia, and the U.S. are bidding against one another for the favors of Germany to the benefit of Germany. And note that even in 52, a united Europe under German domination, their eventual establishment as a third power bloc moving out of NATO and the creation of a European army under German domination, those are beginning to happen. Obviously, Germany has not left NATO, but Trump is moving in the direction, or attempting to move in the direction, of fracturing NATO. And I would submit that not that he's a Russian dupe, but that he is expressing traditional German Ostpolitik.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Now, we began our primary analysis with the open letter to Stalin published by the Bürger Zeitung in 1949, authored by former Nazis Bruno Fricke and Otto Strasser. That paper was described as the primary outlet for the Steuben Society. That organization, as we are about to see, was a primary element of the pro-Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. prior to World War II. From another of the books available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, this is Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld in America by John Roy Carlson, published in hardcover by E.P. Dutton and Company. Of the Steuben Society and its affiliation with Hitler, aristocratic in its class orientation, the Steuben Society hated the German-American Bund because of its difference in tactics, shunned wild Nazi talk, and avoided in recent years the public heiling of Hitler, while the Bund continued as before. It goes back to Steuben Society President Theodor H. Hoffmann's trip to Germany and his reception by Hitler. Hoffmann told the story in a bylined article in the December 20th, 1934 issue of the Deutsche Beobachter, that was the official German Nazi paper, published in New York. Whoever thinks that National Socialism rules by oppression is mistaken. My personal impressions of Hitler were that he is an idealist, an unusual organizer, and a man of tremendous energy. It is my conviction that he is an honest and sincere man in his endeavors not only to unite the German people, but also in his determination to break the chains of slavery. He is the one man who filled the life of the German nation with new hope for the future. And again, that the Steuben Society, whose outlet was the Bürger Zeitung. Now, more about the Steuben Society, this from another book available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, The New Germany and the Old Nazis by P.H. Pettens, copyright 1961, and published in hardcover by Random House. This is about attempts to free Nazi war criminals, rehabilitate, or basically to reinstall them in positions of power in Germany. Obviously, one of the things that was proposed in the Soviet Note of 1952, and it was a long-time goal successfully realized in the bidding between the Soviet Union and the U.S. that was alluded to by Adenauer in the passage we read. Effective schemes had been developed by the Nazis and militarists to obstruct law and justice. After they had reaped success, after thousands of Nazi criminals had fled to Spain and Egypt, after other thousands had been freed from Allied prisons, there appeared accounts in some righteous newspapers congratulating a group of Nazi ringleaders on accomplishing an almost impossible task. The Deutsche Sowjetzeitung of 1958 published a full-page account of a far-reaching secret organization which had been founded in 1948 in violation of Allied rules. By the way, that paper was founded in part with assistance from the CIA. It was headed up by Gerhard Frey, and it was in an interview with Gerhard Frey that Major General Edwin Walker, in an interview with Frey in the Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, in which Edwin Walker first disclosed that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the person who tried to kill him. This despite the fact, this was about a week after Kennedy was killed, this despite the fact that the official version of that event has it that that was first disclosed by Marina Oswald in an interview with the FBI in early November. Once again, of this organization Tetens is writing about, the purpose of the organization was to free the war criminals in defiance of law and justice. The author of this remarkable report, Major General Hans Korte, describes how a kind of general staff or steering committee was set up in Munich to direct all the anti-war guilt propaganda in occupied Germany and throughout the entire world. A group of Nazi jurists who had served in Nuremberg as counsels for major war criminals formed the nucleus of the directing body. Prominent among them were Dr. Rudolf Aschenauer of Munich and Ernst Achenbach of the Naumann Circle of Essen, the latter having excellent financial connections on the Rhine and the Ruhr, and skipping down. Among the organizations abroad working for this network, we find the Kameradenhilfe in Spain, headed up by the SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, a similar group working in Latin America under the leadership of the Luftwaffe ace Colonel Hans Ulrich Rudel, and various German relief and propaganda organizations in the U.S. under the political guidance of the Steuben Society. Again, that is the organization that used the Bürger Zeitung as its primary journalistic outlet, and it basically was part of the Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. prior to the war and the underground Reich milieu in the U.S. after the war. Now, returning to the present, Donald Trump, from the Daily Beast of March 21st of 2016. This is an article by Shane Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S. Donald Trump's new foreign policy advisors are as rotten as his stakes. And it's talking about his advisors, including Joseph E. Schmitz, the former Inspector General of the Armed Forces and the U.S., talking about his advisors and skipping down. Trump revealed little about what specific advice they've given so far or how many of them may have shaped Trump's surprising new position that the U.S. should rethink whatever it needs to remain in the 7-decades-old NATO alliance with Europe. Sounding more like a CFO than a commander-in-chief, Trump said to the alliance, quote, "We certainly can't afford to do this anymore," adding, quote, "NATO is costing us a fortune, and yes, we're protecting Europe with NATO, but we're spending a lot of money." U.S. officials, including former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, have stated that European allies have to shoulder a bigger burden of NATO's cost. But calling for the possible U.S. withdrawal from the treaty is a radical departure for a presidential candidate, even a candidate who has been endorsed by Russian President Vladimir Putin. It also wasn't clear how Trump's arguably anti-interventionist position on the alliance squared with his choice of advisors. Another Trump advisor, Joseph E. Schmitz, has served in government as the Defense Department Inspector General. Schmitz was brought in during the first term of George W. Bush with a mandate to reform the watchdog office, but he eventually found himself the subject of scrutiny, skipping down. Schmitz also raised eyebrows for what the L.A. Times sources described as his unusual fascination with Baron Friedrich von Steuben, a Revolutionary War hero who's regarded as the military's first inspector general. Schmitz first replaced the Defense Department IG's seal in its office across the country with a new one bearing the von Steuben family motto, "Sub tutela, altissimi semper," under the protection of the Almighty always. More about Schmitz. This from that L.A. Times article from September 25th of 2005. By the way, we talked about the Schmitz family in For the Record 476. The scrutinizer finds himself under scrutiny by T. Christian Miller, and this talks about Joseph E. Schmitz, and talking about the corruption in the Pentagon that Schmitz went to great lengths to cover up. That's one of the things that he drew fire for. And skipping down, Some of the more unusual complaints regarding Schmitz deal with what senior officials called an obsession with von Steuben, the Revolutionary War hero who worked with George Washington to instill discipline in the military. Von Steuben reportedly fled Germany after learning that he was going to be tried for homosexual activities. Shortly after taking office, Schmitz made von Steuben's legacy a focus. He spent 3 months personally redesigning the Inspector General's seal to include the von Steuben family motto. Skipping down again, in July of 2004, he escorted Henning von Steuben, a German journalist and head of the von Steuben Family Association, to a U.S. Marine Corps event. He also feeded von Steuben at an $800-a-plate meal allegedly paid for by public funds and hired von Steuben's son to work as an unpaid intern in the Inspector General's office, a former defense official said. He also called off a $200,000 trip to attend a ceremony at the unveiling of a von Steuben statue in Germany. Finally, Schmitz's son, Philip J. Schmitz, has a business relationship with a group tied to von Steuben. Schmitz, who runs a technology firm, provides web hosting services for the World Security Network, a nonprofit news service focused on peace and conflict issues. Von Steuben serves on the network's advisory board. Hubertus Hoffmann, a German businessman who founded the network, said von Steuben played no role in assigning the contract to Philip Schmitz, who was paid a, quote, modest sum, unquote, for his work. Schmitz said he first made contact with Hoffmann through his father, but that he had never met von Steuben. The relationships troubled many at the Pentagon. He was consumed with all things German and all things von Steuben, said the former defense official, who did not want to be identified because of the ongoing inquiries. He was obsessed, unquote. And John Schmitz's brother, Joseph Schmitz's brother, John P. Schmitz, works for a firm that does a lot of work for major German corporations. We went into that in For the Record 476. We will recap that in part two of this series. I simply want to note, and we will go into this at much greater length, what is going on right now. Speaking of those German corporations, many of the most important of which are represented by John P. Schmitz, Joseph Schmitz's brother. Dispute over sanctions on Russia, part two from GermanForeignPolicy.com of May 3rd of 2016. That newsletter feeds along the lower right-hand side of the SpitfireList.com website. German business circles and proxy foreign policy organizations are campaigning to have the sanctions against Russia lifted. More than two-thirds of the people in Germany are in favor of lifting sanctions, reports the Körber Foundation of Hamburg, based on the current opinion poll. And skipping down. The survey shows that 2 years after the escalation of the Ukrainian conflict, a significant estrangement between the populations of the two countries can be noticed. 48% of the Germans perceive Russia as a threat. Only 50% believe emphatically that Russia belongs, quote, to Europe. More than half of the German population considers the EU's policy towards Russia as appropriate. However, when asked which country Germany should work more closely with, 81% of those 1,000 Germans participating in the survey opted for Russia. And also, from GermanForeignPolicy.com, the European War Union about the creation of the German-dominated European army alluded to in the response to the open letter to Stalin, the Soviet Note of 1952, or rather the response to the Soviet Note of 1952. We will go into these at greater length in part two. Also from GermanForeignPolicy.com of June 27th of 2016, flexible union with the European FBI, this from GermanForeignPolicy.com. And again, this is a tall glass of water for one sitting. More in part two. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 918, the Truppenkampfverbande part one, German Ostpolitik part one. This is being recorded on August 18th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.